Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Daryl Trimieu, and he will be speaking on money and morality. So let's listen in on Daryl Trimieu.
It's the parable of the laborer and the vineyards. Laborers in the vineyard. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual day and wage, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. Welcome! Welcome, all you biblically literate people. I'm reading about the laborers in the vineyard. So we may have missed the first few verses. I'm sure you can pick it up. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around, and he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." Notice that. Beginning from the last and going to the first. When those hired by 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Do you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be first, and the first will be last. Now this, of course, predicts the end of the world. That's a joke. That's what I said, if you're wrong there. No, that's not what it's about at all. But what it really is about is a kind of separation of labor from wages. There's several ways of interpreting that parable. Two of the most common ways are understanding that the parable is kind of an example of the gracious generosity of God. That's sort of like what we do in the regular world, so that if you come in the last hour, you still get a daily wage. And I thought that that was, to me, the most persuasive way of understanding the parable. But I heard someone who had studied this, who was a New Testament professor, talk about perhaps that was an example of holiness on the part of the owner of the vineyard, who's flouting as well. You know, you agree to your usual wage, and this person worked only an hour, what is it to you? You agreed, and now you're stuck with it. Well, I don't really suggest either interpretation. There may be another one that you prefer. What I want to call to your attention, though, is the emphasis on wages and labor. And how, in fact, that's always connected with emotions of right. Calvin Coolidge, one of our best-known presidents, has begun to say that the business of America is business. Okay. And I think that one of the primary group metaphors for us in our society is the fable of the grasshopper and the ant. Most of us have heard this when we were children, you know, the grasshopper and the ant in the spring and the summer enjoy warm weather, but the ant assiduously works, storing up grain and seedlings and all the things that insects love to eat, and putting them away for that time that the ant knows will come when the sun does not shine, and hay cannot be made, and the wind does blow. Now the grasshopper, of course, has a different set of values. Eating what he needs to sustain himself while he entertains the grasshoppers and all the creatures with his fiddle. Of course, the seasons do change. The beast comes round at last, so to speak. And the snow starts to fall, and the grasshopper realizes trouble's on the way and knocks on the door of the ant and says, "Oh, ant, brother ant, you know, your spirit died, more or less." And the ant said, "Well, in the summer while I worked, you played. I worked for my supper, now play things." And shuts the door. And we understand that in America to be more or less the height of morality. That is, there's a connection between merit and reward, between foolishness and demerits, or want, as you might want to put it. Want. Well, let me share with you another voice. This is from a young woman named Susan, a welfare recipient who asked that her name really not be used. She has become jaded because of a close encounter with welfare. She had been a law student at a prestigious school in the East when she was diagnosed with a rare disease. Dropped by her medical insurance company, she sought help from the federal government. Quote, "If there's a safety net out there, I sure missed it," Susan says. "The way the system is set up, it forces you to lie unless you can live on $343 a month. If you receive assistance from somewhere else, you lose your benefits. From the moment I approached the system, I was treated like dirt," Susan told Christianity Today. "When they answered that phone call, they made moral assumptions about who you are, that you are undeserving. One woman reached into my purse without asking. As far as she was concerned, I've lost my right to privacy." And I think it's fairly safe to say that this country, essentially, while not being a meritocracy, that is, while not making distributions solely on the benefit of merit, is inclined to reward initiative and hard work. And I don't think I have a problem with that from a moral point of view. Just to give you a little background, I don't know, I'm probably a 7th or 8th generation African American, and I teach at a divinity school in the Portland area, where I divinity school. I am a guy who's always believed in hard work and money. My family was never on welfare, neither my father nor my grandfather nor my great-grandfather. And yet, I think I do have a problem with the way that America cares for people who have needed extra care. We have before us, this is one of my little happy props, I guess I would put money out. I got a little rush to little houses out here. We have Monopoly, and it's very aptly named. It was a game that was invented around the Great Depression. And one of the things I think that's true about it is that it has a wonderful precision and simplicity. The object of the game, has everybody played Monopoly? All right, well, you know, people can tell you what that's about, okay? You know, the one who dies with the most toys wins, more or less. You know, it's an unrelenting logic to it. That is, that you develop your property, that you take certain kinds of risks that are calculated to reward you to take property directly from someone else. You know, it is essentially a zero-sum game. For me to increase, thou must decrease. Okay, that's the logic of Monopoly. And as a game, it can be a lot of fun if it doesn't lead to fist fights. You know, there's a wonderful logic to it, and it is morally acceptable, I think, because of the fact that we realize that it's a game. Okay? Monopoly doesn't take into consideration anything about a person's moral character, or for that matter, the character of the society within which the person or the community is situated. You simply play, and you wind up with everything, or you slowly but surely, you lose your shirt. But of course, when you lose everything, the game is over, but life goes on. The question, of course, is what happens when a monopoly mentality escapes its encapsulated location as a game and becomes an understanding of a way of life? Then I think we begin to have problems in a society. Now think about that. That grasshopper and ant parable is not a parable out of the Bible. Okay? I can't remember whether it's Aesop or Fontaine, but it's a non-biblical parable. And I think what we ought to try and think about is how is the Bible, essentially, how does the Bible look at economic relations? And I'm not going to go through the scriptures that talk about taking care of the widow and the orphan and the sojourner in the land, because I assume you're familiar with those. What I'd like to talk to you about is a variety of ways in which distributions can be made. In a covenanted community, you can have distributions to each according to the effort extended, to each according to promises made, to each according to ability, or perhaps, and somehow I don't see that here, to each according to need. Ah, yes, you feel the Marxist threat already. Because each according to its need, of course, it was one of the tenets in terms of the Leninist Marxist understanding of social contribution and social reward. And in fact, Karl Marx is one of your last great romantics who envisioned creating a society in which you could fish in the morning, work in the afternoon, and listen to concerts in the evenings. One of the things I find least persuasive about Karl Marx is not only his atheism, but also his utopianism. And of course, the realization of Leninist Marxist states in the real world has convinced, I think, most people that, you might say, state-controlled economies are such that they can sustain a form of life, but they have such great drawbacks in terms of their lack of productive capacity and their lack of basic human freedoms that even the Soviets don't want them to. Okay, so I'm not going to make some wild, happy pitch for totalitarian socialism. And I know you may have feared that, but you can relax now. We're not going to go into it. Well, what is money?
Paper.
Metal.
Crystallized sweat. There's a Lockean expert, essentially. Locke, John Locke, who was one of the philosophical founders of our way of life, understood property to be the kind of things in the natural world that you convert it to your own personal use. And the metaphor Locke used was people gathering acorns in the woods. You know, while the acorns live out in the woods, they're common property. But once you have converted them to your own usage, they become your own private property. And in fact, I think this country is founded essentially upon the basis of an unlimited accumulation of private property. And I don't think that's a problem very much with acorns, because there is a limit on the acorns you can gather and store. But when it comes down to paper, which is money, there is not that limit. And that's the world we live in. It's a world of international capitalism. Well, what do we have in terms of images in the Bible? Job starts off rich. He's tested by Satan. Loses everything. Winds up rich. I think it is fair to say that in the Bible, it's not bad to have wealth. Not bad to have money. It's not even moral to have money. The Bible talks about the lust for money being the root of evil, not the possession of it. Yes, we have the parables of a rich young ruler, but I think if you read that parable, the problem is that wealth becomes a sticking point, you know, where mammon is preferred over Christ. Well, at the same time, I'm going to give you the yin, you have to understand that most of the people that are talked about in the scriptures, most of your apostles, most of your prophets died poor. And very few of the great fathers and mothers of the church died with money in their pockets. You know, Calvin, Luther, didn't die wealthy. St. Francis of Assisi and his followers did not believe in, for them at least, in the possession of private property. They believed in the practice of borrowing. But of course, the problem is that one cannot borrow a bucket, or a horse, or a cow, unless there is, in fact, a system that has buckets, and cows, and horses. So that you can say that Francis of Assisi didn't have really a firm understanding of economic relations, because it's dependent upon an economy. Such material items must be established and maintained if they're going to be borrowed. Well, I think for us the question is from not whence doth cometh poverty, but from whence cometh wealth. And in fact, in trying to understand monetary relations in the modern world, we have to talk a little bit about political economy. And notice I've linked two words together, political economy rather than, or political economics rather than just economics. The reason why is that all forms, all systems of economics invariably work hand in glove with systems of politics. And that, in fact, because the system of politics tends to be the one that bears the sword, as Luther would say, it is the system that permits economic relationships. And thus, if you have bad economics, invariably, you can trace or link it with bad politics. So, the fact that 40,000 people starve to death on a daily basis has to do with bad world politics. The fact that one out of every four children in the United States grows up in poverty has to do not just with an economic system that has trouble with distribution, but it has to do with politics that does not value children growing up not in poverty. The state within which I live, Texas, it's one out of five for the U.S., it's one out of four for the state, for Texas, one quarter of the children in the state of Texas with the wild girls in the county, nevertheless, grows up in poverty. Well, does that have, those are just facts. And facts in and of themselves don't constitute a theory. Do we have moral obligations? And if so, whence cometh the obligations? I'd like to open it up. He said, watch out for that sage on the stage business. I take that seriously. Do we have any moral obligations regarding financial affairs? How about, how many of you folks think we do? How many of you think we don't? No libertarians here?
Even if you were a libertarian, I think it's in your self-interest to have a society that doesn't come back and haunt you because of poverty and other factors that really diminish, you know, human life in various areas around the world.
No, I agree with you, but I'm not sure libertarians.
No.
That Hayek and Friedman, I'm not sure they would go that far. I think that's rational and logical, and I agree with you. I'm not sure that they would interpret society in that kind of fashion. Most of us do agree that we have certain kinds of obligations. The question is, what kind of obligations? For instance, do Christians have an obligation for philanthropy?
Yes.
Is it because we're Christians or because we're human?
You're probably both, but Jesus made it pretty clear that's what
we're
supposed to do.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. Is philanthropy, giving people things, does that invariably lead to independence?
Yes.
Is dependency bad?
Yes.
All right, so you've got a moral dilemma, a conundrum there. We're commanded by our Lord and Savior, one we understand to have the real understanding of morality, to be philanthropic, as well as prophets who have preceded Jesus Christ, who just came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it, for us to have alms, to be generous, and, at least in the view of some people, giving people things creates dependency, and I think most of us understand that full-grown human beings should be independent, and thus, creating dependency is problematic, troublesome. So, we're kind of tied up into a catch-22 situation, in which we're darned if we do. darned if we don't!
Aren't we though? I mean, it seems like what you're saying is that it's either all or nothing, the way we are philanthropic about things. It seems to me that there's a middle road where you help people, but the way you help people is by helping them help themselves do things, teaching the fish rather than.
Okay, I have no problems with that. The old Chinese proverb, give a man this inclusive language land, and an era, give a woman, a person, a fish. You feed them a day, teach them to fish, and they feed themselves for a lifetime. I have no problem with that. The question is does our political economy help people to be independent?
Political economy?
Our political.
United States.
We could expand that, but I'll settle for the States for now. Okay.
You read the parable, and then later when you quoted from Mark, it struck me that what that landowner did was something that he had to do. Because he was, the nation that he was in was supposed to, every 50 years, return everything to the original owner, so there should never be day laborers standing around any place. He had all the land, and they could do the work. So he was obligated to pay them, because somehow he wound up with the whole pie. And the system, the political system, should have been made in such a way that there was an evening out process every so often.
Sure.
And we need a system like that, too.
So you're still
waiting for them, but we need something that will work for today.
We need a year jubilee.
Yes.
Okay.
It didn't work then. It won't work then.
Well, I'm going to say the year.
It says it didn't work then. You have sufficient.
Well, I think they did, but rich people had wonderful ways of putting money in different places for a year. You know, the year was over.
So what do you say? We just wait for the eschaton because it doesn't work. Don't do it, right?
I'm just saying that jubilee and that didn't really work for him.
Okay, didn't work then, can't work now. That's one way of looking at it. Yes.
It didn't work because people chose not to make it work.
Okay.
In the same way we choose not to make it work today.
Well, you say self-fulfilling prophecies do.
Yeah,
say it's not going to work, it's not going to work. Can't argue with you. I think we're in agreement on that. Well, let's talk a little bit about capitalism and socialism, because I think what I want to talk to you about is a clearer understanding of modern economics. And again, my background is I was a lawyer for a number of years and realized that I could not fulfill the calling and mission that God had given me in the practice of law. I went to seminary and then grad school and a doctorate in ethics and society, and I teach at a seminary. And I'm not an economist. So, you know, bear with me, is what I'm trying to say. I'm with you. I'm not any economist here. Maybe there are. If so, God bless them, but I'm not. What I want to talk, though, is about some of our political mythology. I want to talk about some of our political economics. Myth number one, the first capitalist countries, England, France, Netherlands, etc., developed by pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps. This is a myth that is commonly believed. Does this mean that England, France, Netherlands, and others did work? Not at all. But rather, we know, in terms of history, that England and other European countries developed largely because of the sea power they had to dominate and exploit the resources of other lands. In fact, between 1650 and 1780, 600 million gold florins were taken by the Dutch East India Company out of the East Indies. 500 million gold pesos were taken from Latin America between 1500 and 1600. 300 million dollars, it's estimated, of value was taken from African Americans in terms of labor out of slavery. So that, in fact, what we call the first world essentially extorted a lot of the wealth in terms of the creation of wealth. But does that mean that the people in those colonies didn't work? I don't mean that at all. The conquistadors, I've been to Cortez's castle, by the way, in Cuernavaca. Pretty well. It's well built. You kind of understand how the Spaniards won, you know. But I mean, they, you know, people came to the New World and they did expend effort. But the question is whether that effort was all that was necessary for the accumulation of wealth that touched off the Industrial Revolution. And I think most historians are now at the realization that, in fact, that wealth did touch off the Industrial Revolution, but the wealth was not directly connected to the issue of merit. In other words, it wasn't just Jeffersonian yeoman farmers growing wheat and growing corn, and this is the sole basis for the American economy. Okay, so one thing we should know is that capitalism, whatever it's worth, does, by necessity, have to capitalize. That in fact, whatever wealth is produced, there is what you call surplus value, which is retained by the owners of the forces of production. And that, even the father of modern political economics, Adam Smith, took the opinion that for there to be one very wealthy person, there had to be several, and not wealthy. Does this mean that we automatically should get rid of capitalism? Not at all. But what I think we have to do is to recognize its nature. You know the old story of the scorpion and the frog. The scorpion wants to go across the lake. The frog can swim across the lake. But the frog is aware that the scorpion is staying on the skin of the scorpion can kill. The scorpion approaches the frog and says, "Will you take me across the lake?" The frog says, "No, you'll sting me and then I'll die. I'll drown." And the scorpion says, "Look, I'm not insane. I don't want to drown. You know I can't swim. That's why I'm asking you to begin with. Take me off. I promise I won't sting you." So the frog says, "Okay," and the scorpion jumps on the back of the frog. The frog starts swimming across the lake. Make sure the scorpion, he is what he is. Takes over and stings the frog, and of course the sting is fatal. And as the frog and scorpion are drowning in the waters, the frog asks, "Why did you do this? You know, don't you realize that now we're both going to die?" And the scorpion says, "That's just my nature." Okay, that's just my nature. And what I'm essentially saying is that capitalism does, of its necessity, to exploit people. That's the necessity of it. The question from the moral point of view is whether or not that exploitation can be buffered, can be corrected, or must, as Willie Loman says, the salesman can't just eat a man up like an orange, suck out all the pulp and throw away the rind. And if you've seen the play, you know the man who says, well, actually, you can. And they do. So that, in fact, Willie ends the play by ending his life in the hopes that he gets insurance for his family because those are the ones he loves and who he worked for, and that's in any way he can at that point in time provide for himself.
Can you look at your kind of basic premise for just a minute? Your basic premise is that capitalism, by its nature, has to use people or has to.
That's absolutely
true. But is that true? Is it that capitalism uses people, or that people use people, and capitalism is one way that happens?
Vehicle.
Well, capitalism is a system created by people.
Because it seems to me capitalism...
I'm not sure I understand any distinction.
Well,
once
okay.
Again, let's see if I can...
It seems to me capitalism works the best when everybody's winning. You know, when the laborer is getting a fair wage, when the person who owns the factory is getting something back for the risk that he's taking. You know what I mean? When everybody's benefiting, then it's working the best. And it can and does work that way sometimes.
Well, you know, to that I say, the production of wealth historically took off with the exploitation of people. And in fact, you can see that most of y'all are Lutherans, right? Well, what was Luther's idea about charging interest? It was that it was usury. So that the Industrial Revolution doesn't take off until. I was raised Presbyterian, so I'll take some of the heat. Till Calvin says, well, no, you know, you can have banking, you can charge a moderate amount of interest, and this is really when the Industrial Revolution starts taking off. When there is a certain kind of exploitation and accumulation of capital. My point I think I'm trying to make is you make a distinction I don't quite grasp between the people and the system, and I take the position that people are not animals, that we create systems. And from, again, I'm not an economist. I'm an ethicist. I take the position people have to be responsible.
But people got used in communism. People get used in any system.
Well, that's
it
true.
It isn't the system that causes people to get used. It's people who cause people to get used. They can use any system available to them to do it.
You may have some merit there. When I had a business, I charged my clients more than it cost me to produce the product. And people who worked for me, I rewarded them less than I did myself. Because I had a business 6 or 7 years, you had to turn a profit. You know. In other words, I retained surplus value. And I paid my bills with it and supported my family with it. Okay. And exploited the secretaries and others who worked for me. You know, while providing them with jobs, I didn't, you know, whatever their value was, I didn't divide that absolutely equally for every dollar they may have brought me in. Okay? You know,
but the
point.
You're using the word exploitation, and
if you want the retention of surplus value better, I'm not going to that. Don't get me wrong, I don't think you can run a business and show no profit. The businesses I observed that were in operation that returned no profits were either non-profit corporations who whatever they produced did not have to generate a profit or they went out of business. Okay. The point I'm trying to make is, again, the Willie Loman point, not necessarily the dismantling of capitalism. But how many of you remember Alexander Dubček? Okay, that one's down. Well, Dubček was the leader of the Prague Spring around 1968, and Czechoslovakia thought they finally would climb out of the underfront of the Iron Curtain, right? And Czechs were all happy in the streets, and there was going to be liberalization, and we know what happened. questions sent in text, and that was in the box spread. So Dubček said, he's looking for socialism as a human face. And I think, really, for those of you before you drift off to sleep, what I'm trying to talk about here is capitalism, perhaps, with a human face. Uh-oh. No, not already. What time is it?
No, we have.
Somebody else.
Oh, okay. You see what I'm trying to... In other words, in the richest country in the world, with the most advanced health provider system in the world, why should 40 million Americans go without health insurance? Now, does that mean that we, you know, fire all doctors and shoot all nurses? No, I'm not suggesting that at all. But what I'm saying is rather than break down the complete health provider system, perhaps we need to look at some form of health care. In fact, I wrote my dissertation, since I'm revealing it all, on economic rights as being a form of human rights. And one of the things I suggest is, everybody agrees you have to pay for a police force and a fire department, and that those are the services that society should provide, and are not commodities like a sack of wheat. Why should healthcare be considered differently? Okay, why can't that be a service? Like the fire department, or the police department. You know, if a hobo is sleeping in the park and somebody tries to mug them, and a policeman steps on the scene, he doesn't get up there and stop and say, it doesn't look like you paid taxes for this service. Go ahead and mug him. You know, that's not the way it works, right? And if you live in a shanty and it's on fire and the fire trucks come by, they don't stop and say, tax base is kind of low here. Let's dig a trench around it. After it burns down, let's make sure it doesn't spread to other parts of the city. You see what I'm saying? Essentially what I'm saying is that every economy has to be for people. You can't have people working for an economy unless you like irrationality. You know, you have economies, you have political systems, all systems for the people who create them. If it's not in their benefit, then it's essentially irrational and dysfunctional. That's all I'm saying. Now, how do you, in fact, make the kinds of necessary changes? I see you coming up to you. How do you make the necessary changes to do that? We can talk about there's several different kinds of ways. I'm not doctrinaire, so... I do believe that people are created in the image of God, and therefore they're important. Yes.
What you need is a regulator. Now, that's where the problem lies. Who's the regulation? I mean, who's going to be the regulator? And then you need a regulator to regulate the regulator. And it all falls back, at least in my thinking, to the nature of man himself.
Okay. So you said the problem cannot be solved, or that it's inherent in the nature of human society that the problem cannot be solved.
Well, I can say this. We can at least make it so it doesn't hurt too many people.
Okay. Well, I look at it this way. I'm an evangelical. I'm also a Jeffersonian Democrat. If I had to choose between a free press and a strong government, I'd choose the free press every time. At the same time, Rush and I don't see eye to eye on many things. And I do believe that the regulator that you talk about is the government. And the government of a democratic society. And in such a government, the officers there are the servants of the people. You vote them in, you vote them out. This is not true. Stockholders. And think about it. If you're the CEO of a Fortune 500 company and your job is based upon showing profit dividends to stockholders, and you could say clean up the tailings of a copper mine or close down the mine and move it, which might you do? You want to retain your own individual seating. Maybe hitting a little close to home here, but you get my point. It's not the nature of capitalism to say, people around that mine really think better of me really bring a nice turkey at Christmas if I make sure that all environmental issues are covered well, even though that cuts deeply into the profit margin and the profit dividend for the stockholders is fairly minimal. I'm going to do that anyway, because that's the right thing to do. And after I'm fired, perhaps what I've done will serve as an inspirational example to the next CEO.
You want some fire.
Okay? What I'm suggesting to what this gentleman has said, that you in fact have to have government as a regulator, because capitalism is like a team of horses. You know, I'm not saying shoot them. I'm saying put some bits in their mouths. And let's do that as citizens of a democracy. We're voting the people who are the regulators. We can make sure that the FDA checks out drugs so that we don't have to let them have babies. Well, we can do that. There are things we can do. We can do. Everything is not beyond our reach, even though, in fact, you have multinational corporations that are all incorporated somewhere, and the stockholders all live somewhere, which means that they're finally always subject to state power, if the citizens of the state will make them be responsible. And that's what I'm arguing for. Yes?
If you look around the world in the late 20th century, do you think there's any country that is approaching that model?
Yeah, you've had some waxing and waning and some adjustment in some of the Scandinavian countries, Norway and Sweden and Denmark, with regard to the social net they have provided for their citizens, but they provide that net. Well, there's problems there right now.
Saturation point.
Yeah.
And it's still a regulator.
Yes, sir. I'll never argue with you that I agree with you inherently. They have to be regulated. I'm a Calvinist. You know, I always think that people, human beings, are created. God may have created us originally without sin, but that Calvinist notion of human nature being somewhat twisted and requiring regulators is deep in my blood, for better or for worse. I don't say I'm right. I just say that's the way I look at it.
I kind of like to look at, in some ways, at Canada as an example. Of course, they haven't had to bear the brunt of being the, you know, kind of the military side of what we viewed was our role against the Eastern Bloc. But, you know, they have national health care and don't think twice about it. They've had to provide infrastructure for a humongous country, roads throughout a huge land, and they've done it and maintain a fairly decent standard of living.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a matter of choices.
It's a matter of choices. Hey, Bernie?
They have debt. That's right. I mean, they've paid a price for that.
They have. But now, you know, I asked one class, maybe I don't know if I dare ask this one. Shall I be risk averse and calculator business the way Milton Friedman says we should be? Or should I be daring Christian? Daring Christian. I teach seminary, I teach a variety teacher. Everybody I teach claims to have a calling. So one day in my social ethics class, I said, now how many of you would, if you could, simply by raising your right hand, create a world in which you would have a place to live and something to eat, perhaps a car among two or three of you, and, you know, would seldom be out of work. You would not be constrained to take necessarily any kind of particular job. And you would have freedom of speech and of religion and all the Bill of Rights freedom guarantees. But in creating such a world, you would no longer have Horatio Alger opportunity. You would no longer necessarily be able to be Donald Trump or whomever the prince at the time. And also, in creating this world, the 40,000 people who starved to death today, none of them would starve to death. Everybody, in fact, in the world would have modest living. How many of you would be willing to give up the possibilities America presents for such a world?
Sounds like a pointless playing games and not keeping points. Everybody.
Well, I got three people who put bands here. My class full of seminarians, all of them, most of them have already served churches. I got in my book. And that makes you, it made me wonder. I sat down and fought over for a good one.
Well, the question, that's an interesting question, because does that also mean a world with no risks and no failures? Is that what you're promoting?
No, I'm not promoting that at all. I mean, let's face it, we come into the world and, you know, there are some Christians like myself that believe in a second coming. And Jesus could descend in the clouds. But I don't wait at the window. Okay? And I assume if Christ doesn't come again before I die, I'm going to die. And so I'm risk averse. I put on my seatbelt. I ride a bike. I try and get a helmet. You know, I take some risks. I started my own business. I took some risks. And I'm not suggesting a world without risks. I'm not suggesting the Soviet Union.
Okay. I thought you were suggesting maybe no risk, because what creates...
I don't think you can create a world without risks. Even the Soviet Union, you have risks. Say something wrong with the Politburo and you wind up in a gulag. So I don't believe in utopias. And I'm not even suggesting we create one. What I am suggesting is that we understand that the economic system that prevails in the world is not beyond the responsible control of citizens in free countries. That's all I'm saying.
You are a Calvinist.
I'm a Calvinist. I believe in the transformation of the world. That's the calling of Christians. And I beat me outside or inside. That's just me.
I was just wondering, in your scenario, I somehow got the idea that personal choice was being effective. I mean, the presence of evil in the world is the outcrop of our personal choice. And
I think even in my scenario, that evil is not eliminated. Again, I'm no utopian.
Right, okay.
You know, some of the Scandinavian countries have the highest level of suicide in the Western world. So I'm not just saying that's Shangri-La. They have no problems. I'm not suggesting that at all. In fact, I know some of those countries have real problems with things like child pornography.
Yes, I know.
So that's another lecture, another lesson. But you see my point. I don't think they're perfect societies, and I didn't mean to imply that.
Well, I guess all I heard you saying is that it's a game, and everyone will get a little piece, and no one will have this much, and no one will have this much. We'll all sort of be in the middle, perhaps. And I think that it's worth working toward. I mean, I worked with men in shelters in Seattle who never got a chance at any sort of, you know, economic security. And, you know, we're all debating, well, in this sort of society, will we still have risk or personal? You know, it's to me, it is human rights.
It is human rights. Well, I see your point. All I know is my understanding of, you know, of this country's history. And you can see it really in my own background. My mother was born in North Carolina as a sharecropper and a sharecropper family that went back into slavery. And there was no possibility of any kind of personal initiative, because when you're a sharecropper, it's the company's store. It's born on the other man's land, and you till it, you repair farms, you produce the crop. And when you die, if you don't get off of that, your children are just born. God, my mother, sharecropping was World War II. It wasn't the church. It wasn't good feelings. It wasn't really, you know, initiative by my grandfather who stayed sharecropping. It was the fact that you had World War II and you had industries. Somebody had to make those bombs, and my mother was kind of Rosie the Riveter and got out of sharecropping and changed essentially our family history.
So there were opportunities, the war caused it, there were opportunities for her to take personal.
Well, she had a family of 11, and somebody had to go.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
I think part of my problem with your scenario is that the little red hen is so ingrained in, you know, who will help me collect this wheat, who will help me bake this bread, you know, not eyes of the duck, not eyes of the cat, not eyes of the pig. Well, then you can't share in the bread at the end of the book. That's a strong...
Yeah. But you know, here's where I might be speaking for the fourth time, because someone's got to let the little red head. If the grasshopper and the ant are not that crazy. I guess I'm trying, because with the grasshopper and the ant, you know the grasshopper's going to die. With a little redhead, we're down in parables. This is what's really confusing. With a little redhead, they just don't get any bread.
The
next time they might say yes. And maybe instead of having nice fresh bread, they just get a few scraps of grain or whatever they get fed. And, you know, it's not Sturm und Drang, you know. It's not the end of the line if they don't join in. Which makes it, I guess, a little more morally appealing to me. Or perhaps it's I just speak with a forked tongue. I don't know.
I think it's a huge myth in American culture, though, that everybody who's poor deserves to be, but somehow they haven't worked for money, or they haven't put their time in. It's a huge myth. All these men that I work with in Michelle worked their whole lives at construction or, you know, whatever, were injured, laid off, and ended up in the shelter. You know, it's just... I get very upset at this stuff because there is so much non-opportunity in this country. There's a certain group of people who have very large opportunities and a very large group that have very few.
Yeah. I guess what I really want is to see somebody regulate, as this gentleman put it, and clean up. I mean, you go to Appalachia and you see coal miners in West Virginia, and they're born into a coal mining family. And they don't know anything else, they have no other skills. There's nothing else for them to do. And when the vein of coal is worked out, the company doesn't retrain them. Oh, you didn't catch black lung. So we're going to invest some money in you and make you a computer operator. You know, it's like, well, you know, the vein ran out. We discovered some, you know, other vein of coal in Saskatchewan or someplace. We're moving company headquarters. You know, the thing I guess I'm trying to get people to realize is that, in fact, we allow unregulation. We allow it.
Well,
that's really where the sin lies.
It isn't just people that can't get jobs like the ones you're talking about. We live in Vancouver, Washington, and that's not a huge city, but we have homeless people in Vancouver who are working. They have jobs, and they are being paid minimum wage. And they are working every day, and everything is on a shoulder enough that they can't ever get up enough money to pay the first and last rent on an apartment without assistance. And we're trying to get assistance for them through nonprofit. But the system isn't taking care of paying enough for even working people to get a house or a shelter.
And the only way I can describe a system like that is it's dysfunctional. And the question is, again, what is it, you know, when we say a system like that is dysfunctional and we live in a democracy, we can't say the Tsar did it. You know, everybody can vote. You can vote congressmen and senators in or out. And if you have a dysfunctional system, you have to take responsibility in a democracy. Now, does that mean I have all the answers? Not at all. I'm just saying that we solve problems by addressing problems.
I'm just curious as to what signs of hope anybody in this room might see for changing the American economy to be a little bit more people honoring instead of money honoring.
I've got one I can share with you. You have Brazil. I have to make it into international. You have Brazilians who want to now cut down their rainforest to develop their economy. And the Brazilians said, well, we'll cut down your forest to develop your economy. That's how you develop economies. We want to cut down us to develop our economy. And we have not just environmentalists, but all kinds of scientists that realize that a good deal of the world's air is produced by Brazilians. now have some people who are saying, wait a minute. Hold on. Let's talk this one over. We can't tell you you don't have a right to develop your economy and develop your nation, because that's nonsense. Every nation follows its national vital interests. But perhaps we can compensate you for not cutting down these trees. And I think that that example, slim as it is the key to understanding the way out. That is, we're all in it together. You know, that in fact, it's an interdependent planet. And that if we don't work with Brazilians and other people around the globe, we will perish. And it's not really technically in the trade. We don't call that morality, we call that prudence. That's prudentiality. But I think prudentiality may, as we begin to take, to associate those kinds of analogies with things that happen internally in our country, that may help us work our way out.
Business is starting that kind of thinking too. There's companies are starting win-win policies where you have a conflict and you're trying to find a way to both win in the situation, rather than just management winning or the workers winning. And also there's a thing as a almost a reverse pyramid, where instead of you have the CEO at the top of the, you know, you reverse the pyramid so you realize that your secretary is the one. Whoever, workers are the ones who are really making this company go, and the management of those who support them and help them do their job and get it done. I think those are all hopeful people kind of.
I think you're right. I think there's one other thing that is happening now, which is more occupied production, because they've discovered that where people have more say and how things are produced, that in fact they can generate greater profit. So, you know, to a certain extent, even that profit motive can help in terms of making ownership more democratic. But we have a long way to go, and I guess what I want to do is talk about a little bit about the responsibility of the church. Because, let's assume just for the sake of argument that I'm right, you know, all these CEOs, he would have rock. All these CEOs, like slave owners or the leaders of campaigns against Native Americans, most of these people are Christians. You know, most of these people go to church somewhere. In my own community of Fort Worth, we have Stembo, whose brother was one of the chief CEOs at General Motors. And one of the most interesting things that was happening there was, capital was having to fund the labor. There were plants in Flint, there were plants in Fort Worth. Stemple would go to one and say,